Esther sat in her rocking chair with her eyes closed and her hand near her breast, caressing something that hung from the chain around her neck. It took me a moment to realize that her face was streaked with tears, and she was softly crying, her chair moving slightly in time with the music. I knocked gently on the door, and her eyes opened. She quickly wiped back her tears.
"Is that you, Helen?"
"It's me, Michael. I brought your dinner." I stepped into the room, setting the tray on a collapsible stand next to the bed. As I neared, I could see that the pendant she had been fondling was the petite silver locket I had found the week before. I lifted the cover from her tray. "Dinner is served."
"That doesn't smell like ham."
Helen stopped me on the way up. "Apparently you tried to pull a fast one on me." She did not answer the charge.
"Where is Helen?"
she demanded. "She had errands to run, so she left early. She asked that I read you the obituaries, then take you out for exercise." She made no attempt to conceal her disapproval.
"You have the Tribune?"
"Right here."
"It must be the Salt Lake City Tribune. You can turn off the music."
I reached over to the boxy phonograph and lifted its needle from a well-worn vinyl record.
"Sit close enough that I can hear you. Your voice is soft."
"Don't you want to eat first?"
"No,"
she replied tersely. I recovered her dinner, then sat down on the bed next to her and ruffled open the paper to the obituaries and began to read. "Dennis Machum, beloved husband and father, left this..."
"Not the whole thing, just the names."
I glanced up. "Names it is." I proceeded along the page. When I had read the last of the announcements, I rolled the paper back up. "That's it."
"You read all of them?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Are you certain?"
"There were only 12 today. You were expecting someone?"
"No one in particular."
She crossed her hands in her lap and sat back quietly. "I'll take you on your walk now, if you like."
"I don't need to walk."
"Gotta walk," I said as I stood. "You need exercise." I reached out to take her arm. She recoiled at my touch.
"I don't need to walk."
"Yes, you do." Her face stiffened.
"I will not walk with you."
Her stubbornness angered me. "If you want to veg out here on someone else's time, that's up to you. But I've got a job to do, and it will do you some good to get out of here."
"What do you know about my good? You're not a nurse. You don't have experience. You know nothing about caring for someone else."
It was neither the first nor the harshest of the indignities I had fielded from her. But there was something about what she said that cut deep, that flashed my temper, and I was as surprised by my reaction as she was. "For the last 2 years I have done nothing but take care of someone else. I did everything for my mother, from spoon-feeding her to wiping up her vomit, right up until the minute she died. I think I know something about caring for someone." My voice rang off in silence, and Esther neither spoke nor moved, but faced quietly ahead. I sighed in exasperation, embarrassed at my outburst. I conceded her the victory and stood to go when, without explanation, Esther slowly raised herself, extending her arm out to me. It was my first glimpse inside the shell of which Helen had spoken. I gently took her by the elbow, and we began to walk. Though I had not before seen her out of the chair, she was not infirm and moved rather agilely, relying on me only for guidance. After 15 minutes of pacing the third floor in solitude, she said,
"You loved your mother, didn't you?"
"She was my best friend."
"I don't remember my mother. She died a week after I was born. My father raised me."
I didn't reply, and she was suddenly withdrawn. Nothing more was said until we returned to her room. She felt for her bed, then sat down.
"I wish to take a nap. Please shut my door when you leave.
I retrieved Helen's newspaper from the bureau.
Would you like your dinner warmed?
She shook her head.
It will be all right.
Then I'll be back tomorrow.
She stopped me at the doorway.
Michael?
Yes?
Do you suppose life gives us second chances?
What do you mean?
If we've made a mistake in our lives, do you think that God or fate gives us a second chance to make it right?
I considered the question.
I don't know. But we'd probably just make the same mistake over again.
Her countenance fell, and her sadness resonated through her voice.
Thank you for reading to me.
I was unhappy to have contributed to her sadness.
Maybe I'm wrong. I just don't think I've seen any second chances in my life.
Perhaps you don't know how to recognize them.
As I drove home that night, I was still wondering what she meant. Chapter 8. The Christmas Social.
An old acquaintance of my father's came through Bethletown today. He was on his way back from California, where he has amassed a small fortune. He boasted greatly at my father's expense. There are those who go about their lives sharpening their egos on the grindstone of others' failures.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. Fay returned from Baltimore excited about school and the challenge of a new life in a new city. She also returned with an apartment and a date to inhabit it. Her departure was scheduled for December 28th, which left us little more than 3 weeks together. Impending distance, I found, also makes the heart grow fonder, and as the calendar waned, I numbered the days with growing anxiety. My lunchtime discussion with Alice had helped put my relationship with Fay in perspective. It was not that I hadn't considered marrying Fay, as she had requested of me. More accurately, the opposite was true. I had considered it too deeply. And while it may be prudent to not leap until one looks, the longer one stands on the edge of a precipice, the less likely one is to jump, as one becomes more painfully aware of the length of the fall. It did not help me that there were so many shoutings out the dangers. The Murrows' annual Christmas party was a spectacular affair, attended by most of Ogden's affluent, and the Murrow home was dressed as lavishly as the prosperous guests it anticipated receiving. Outside, the trees were awash in white and gold lights, and holly and pine garlands wound around the home's staircase banister and light fixtures and anywhere else that lent itself to Yule dressing. The home smelled of pine and wassail and perfumed candles. By dusk, it was crowded with humanity. Fay and I were sitting in the dining room, surrounded by a dozen or so guests, when Dr. Murrow entered the room accompanied by a broad-shouldered, gray-haired man and a woman who looked 20 years younger. His hand was behind the man, while the other held a Chardonnay. The man and woman also held drinks.
"There's my Fay,"
he proclaimed, gesturing toward her with the drink.
"Fay, you remember Dr. and Mrs. Baird?"
Mrs. Baird gawked.
"I can't believe how you've blossomed. You are just lovely."
Fay rose.
"Thank you,"
she replied modestly.
"I understand that you are following in your father's footsteps," Mrs. Baird said. "I'm trying, thanks in part to Dr. Baird. Thank you again, Doctor, for your letter of recommendation."
The man smiled.
"I'm glad that someone still considers it of merit. I understand it was of some efficacy."
"Yes, I was accepted to Johns Hopkins. It's a dream come true."
He raised his glass to her.
"Well, congratulations. The letter was certainly penned without reservation. You will be an asset to the profession."
"Who is this handsome young man?"
Mrs. Baird asked, looking toward me.
"This is Michael, my boyfriend," Fay said.
So, Murrow, you'll be losing your daughter twice,
the doctor said jovially. Dr. Murrow did not find the observation amusing, and his skin tightened over his cheeks. He looked down at me, then suddenly smiled maliciously. His voice boomed.
Jenny asked me to talk to these kids about how foolish it would be to get married so young. So I asked Michael how he plans to pay the rent. God will provide, he said. So I asked him how he plans to put food on the table. God will provide, he said again. I went back and told Ginny that the bad news is that our daughter is going to be homeless and hungry. The good news is that her boyfriend thinks I'm God.
The dining room crowd roared. Fay glared at her father indignantly. He noticed her wrath and turned to his guests.
Let me get you some more wine. Fay, give me a hand.
Fay set down her drink and left the room with him.
Fay's always been one of our favorites, Mrs. Baird confided. She is such a dear.
A few minutes later, Fay returned alone. Her jaw was tight, and her eyes were red-rimmed.
Come on, Michael. We're leaving.
I set aside my punch.
What's wrong? Just take me away from here.
As soon as we got to her car, she broke down crying.
What happened back there? You mean besides being humiliated in front of everyone?
Well, that's standard fare for your father.
They're so mean. They're just so damn mean.
What else happened, Fay?
For the first time, my mother got involved. She says that I'm tearing apart our family.
She wiped back her tears.
I love them, Michael. I don't want to hurt them.
She looked up at me through swollen eyes.
What is so wrong with loving you?
It hurt me to see Fay's pain, and while her father was the vehicle of that misery, I was the catalyst in its creation. In a sense, her father and I were both competing for the same woman, and such competitions, in nature or elsewhere, are never amiable. Unfortunately, I was the more easily removed from the equation. I had nothing to say of comfort, so I just quietly held her and ached with her for the pain that I brought. Chapter 9. The Doctor's Threat.
Today, a Mr. Foster booked a room in the inn. He is a wealthy man and had come to Betheltown at the prospect of purchasing the Pate Mine. He spoke condescendingly to me as I served him his dinner. Then I suppose he decided me attractive as he expressed his desire for me to dine with him. I declined his offer. Rich company, like rich food, is often a cause of indigestion.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. I will never cease to be amazed by our species' keen ability for denial. Prior to my coming to the Arcadia, I had never given much thought to growing old or to those who had. It was not a conscious evasion, simply the consequence of circumstance. I didn't know anyone elderly. Both of my parents had died by the age of 45. I had no close grandparents, on my father's side by choice, and on my mother's side by death. So the elderly remained to me people of a foreign culture, as removed from my everyday thoughts as the French, a culture I had occasional contact with, knew a few words of their native tongue, but had little relevance to my daily life. While this may be understandable, the difference to me is that we will not all be Parisians some day, but unless death plays its trump card in an early hand, we will all grow old. But, like I said, we are keen at denial, and old age, like death, is always someone else's destination. Wednesday morning, Helen wore a bright green sweater adorned with knit Christmas ornaments. She stopped to talk with me in the break room.
I noticed on Esther's fitness schedule that you have her walking every day now.
You seem surprised.
Frankly, I am. No one beside me has ever been able to get her out of her room.
You didn't think to tell me that?
I thought I'd just throw you into the lion's den and see if you came out alive.
I smirked. That's probably better I didn't know that. She's a peculiar woman.
Do you know much about her?
As much as anybody, I suppose.
She came to us from a rest home in Bountiful. But she's originally from a small mining town called Bethel, out near Tooele. The place is just a ghost town now.
How did you learn that?
I asked her.
She handed me my schedule.
I see you're working for Alice on Christmas Eve.
Is there a problem with that?
No, I just wanted to make sure she didn't coerce you into it.
She didn't even ask.
Just let me know if she becomes a problem,
Helen said as she left the room. Later that afternoon, for the first time, I took Esther walking on the second floor, reasoning that a change of scenery might be nice. It was for me, though, not her, as it didn't really matter to a blind woman. As we passed the closed door of room 6, I could hear Henri hacking inside. I grimaced.
He sounds like he's getting worse.
Do you know Henri?
Esther nodded.
I'll tell you something about Henri.
I expected a great revelation about the silent man.
Henri's old.
I grinned. Everyone here is old.
Henri's really old, even to me. He lost his leg in World War I. A shell took it off at the knee.
How do you know that?
He told me.
Henri speaks?
If he has a mind to. He just doesn't have much to say to most folk, especially white folk. He doesn't trust them.
Well, he needs to trust someone. I'm having trouble getting him to take his medication, and he won't stop smoking.
Perhaps he doesn't want to get better.
You think he wants to die?
He is all alone. His friends are all dead. He is a decorated war hero, but is put in diapers. Would you want to keep living?
Probably not, I decided.
No,
she gently echoed.
Probably not.
As I contemplated her words, there was suddenly screaming down the hallway.
Just a moment, I said.
I left Esther standing next to the wall and ran around the corner to investigate the commotion. Near the second floor landing, a cluster of residents surrounded Della and Edna, who had squared off in their wheelchairs, metal to metal, their fists raised for combat. Before I could reach them, they went at each other, and Edna grabbed Della's hair and yanked her back, while Della issued forth a shrill scream. I pried my way into the brawl, catching a hand across my cheek as I pushed the two wheelchairs apart. Sharon arrived just then and stood back to watch my handling of the conflict.
Ladies, what's going on here?
The women stared hatefully at each other. Edna was the first to speak, pointing a willowy finger in accusation.
This common thief stole my purse.
She turned to Della, her face further contorting in fury.
If I had a flat iron, I'd show you what for.
I faced Della, who was still panting heavily.
Is it true, Della?
I found that purse. I didn't know it was hers.
Della, give Edna her purse back. Della did not respond, but stared vehemently at her accuser.
She can't give it back,
Edna said impatiently.
She lost it.
Della looked suddenly penitent.
Is that true, Della? You've already lost it?
Not already,
Edna piped in.
Back in 42.
Della took your purse 40 years ago, and you are just getting mad at her now?
I just remembered it,
Edna said. Sharon covered her mouth to keep from laughing out loud, then stepped forward and took the handles of Della's chair.
Come on, Della, I'll take you downstairs.
With the women separated, I returned to Esther, who had groped her way along the wall to a chair.
I sat down next to her. Sorry I stranded you here.
That's all right. Della and Edna at it again over the purse.
They've done this before?
Every few weeks, Edna remembers that purse and goes after Della.
I shook my head.
That poor woman.
Della shouldn't even be in here.
Why is that?
She had her own home bought and paid for. A place she could dig in her own garden. She liked to do that. Had her own flower garden.
What happened to it?
Her children in Seattle invited her up for a visit, then sold the place out from under her. They claimed they did it for her own good, but they just wanted their inheritance. They decided Della was living too long, so they just took it. It is despicable, she said tersely.
I believe there are special lakes in hell reserved for people who prey on the defenseless.
Then you believe in hell, she said.
It's easier to believe in than heaven.
I believe in hell and in heaven. But I think they're the same place.
How's that?
I believe death wakens us to the consequences of our actions, to feel the sorrow or joy we have caused in our lifetime. The location is irrelevant.
What of the talk of fire and brimstone?
It is figurative. How else could such torment be described?
It would be just, I decided.
I believe heaven is just,
Esther said.
She suddenly asked,
Where are you from, Michael?
I was born in Cheyenne, but we moved a lot. I was only 12 when my mother and I came to Ogden.
What part of Ogden?
Initially, wherever we parked. We lived in a 20-year-old station wagon for about 6 months.
Where was your father?
I don't know. By then it was pretty much moot. I looked around. Ready to start walking again?
Esther nodded, and I stood, helping her up. Sharon approached.
Michael, there's a gentleman waiting downstairs to see you. A distinguished-looking, impatient gentleman.
I'm not expecting anyone.
Perhaps he's from the university,
she ventured.
I'll finish with Esther if you like.
I squeezed Esther's hand.
We're not going to make it through this today.
Go see your visitor,
Esther said. Sharon took Esther's arm, and I made my way downstairs. On the main floor, Dr. Murrow sat on one of the burgundy vinyl chairs near the front counter. The last I had seen of him was a few nights back at the Murrow's Christmas party. He looked up, casually following my descent.
Hello, Michael.
Dr. Murrow, what brings you here?
He pushed himself up from his knees and reached out his hand. I took it awkwardly.
Sorry to interrupt your work. I thought I would come by and see if you would be so kind as to dine with me tonight.
He spoke with uncharacteristic pleasantness, and it struck me as odd.
I'm not off until 6, but Faye's out tonight with some of her girlfriends.
Faye needn't join us. I thought it would be just the two of us. I could pick you up around 6.
If this was an ambush, I wanted my own means of retreat.
I'll meet you.
La Fleur-de-Lis around 6? My treat, of course.
And he smiled again. We both knew it was an offer I couldn't refuse.
6 it is.
Splendid. I'll be waiting.
I wondered what he was waiting for. A quarter after 6, I arrived at the luxurious French restaurant. The parking lot was a showcase of the automotive elite. Bright sports cars with feminine curves and liquid shines, and the hubris-polished chrome-grilled cars of European descent. The valet gazed at my car in amusement.
Want me to park it for you?
Yeah, why not?
I handed him my keys and entered the dimly lit restaurant. The maitre d' followed my entrance with disapproval, then, without comment, disappeared into the cloakroom and brought me out a navy jacket.
Perhaps you'd feel more comfortable in this, he said haughtily.
Just then, Dr. Murrow emerged from the sconce-lit dining room. He was dressed impeccably in a dark wool suit, single-breasted, with a red silk tie adorned with a coat-of-arms pattern. On his lapel was a gold AMA pin.
"Michael, I'm glad you could make it,"
he said, as if he had doubted my arrival.
"I've reserved us a place."
I followed him back to an oblong table set for two with crystal goblets before sculpted cloth napkins and a linen-lined basket of baguette and an open bottle of scotch. In the center of the table, a small silver vase held fresh hyacinths. He motioned to my seat, then sat down himself. He immediately reached for the bottle.
"Have you ever had the pleasure of drinking Laphroaig?"
"No, sir."
"It's a magnificent scotch. Wonderful flavor, dry peat and heather overtones."
I thought he sounded like an advertisement. "Actually, I don't drink."
"This may cure you of that,"
he said, pouring me a glass.
"I'm prescribing a dram. A little libation is good for the heart."
My father used to say that. The doctor was not pleased with the comparison.
"So, you are a teetotaler?"
"Yes, sir."
"Call me Ben."
He poured himself a glass of the scotch and sipped it slowly, which I thought he did more for me than himself.
"It defies even scientists why scotch cannot be made anywhere but in Scotland. Business deals are always sealed with the dram. It is the drink of farewell and completion."
I wondered why he was telling me this. A tuxedo ensembled waiter appeared, flicked open our napkins, laid them across our laps, then presented open menus, the entrees described in scripted French. I could have fed myself for a week on the cost of an entree.
"Have you dined here before?"
the doctor asked. I looked up from my menu. "No, it's not exactly in my budget." He nodded smugly, and I knew that I had delivered another arrow to his quiver. Honesty was always one of my weaknesses.
"I recommend the Chateaubriand. If you like shellfish, the Le Coquille is also quite good. It is served in a cognac sauce."
He looked at me condescendingly.
"I think that should be all right for a teetotaler."
I ignored his remark as I looked back down at the menu. A moment later, Dr. Murrow raised his hand and a waiter advanced to our table.
"What may I bring you tonight, Dr. Murrow?"
"The Chateaubriand and the field green salad with your house vinaigrette."
"And you, sir?"
"I'll have the same," I said.
The waiter took our menus. Dr. Murrow tore a piece of bread.
"I once considered that I might be a chef. I enjoy cooking. Rarely get the chance to get to it, though. Of course, Ginny's no slouch in the kitchen."
"Is Mrs. Murrow out tonight?"
"No,"
he succinctly replied. As the evening advanced, the doctor spoke with increasing casualness, as if we were frequent dinner companions or drinking buddies, and this had the effect of causing me greater trepidation. It was not until our entrees were delivered that he offered the first clue about his agenda. He lifted his glass.
"I am certain that you are speculating as to why I wish to speak with you. We have not been exactly,"
he cautiously chose the word,
"friendly."
I awaited his explanation.
"Frankly, I wanted to apologize for how I have treated you. There is more to you than I've given you credit for."
"More?"
"I have concluded that you're not just some love-struck kid out looking for a pretty skirt. I believe that you really do love my daughter."
I was astonished at his admission. I cared deeply about Faye.
"My point," he said quickly. "I believe that you do. And what is love if it's not that?"
He cut into his tenderloin, speared it, then smiled as he chewed.
"Love is such a trite expression these days. We men like the way a woman looks, and we claim a state of love like we might an ailment. But there is more to love than that, isn't there?"
"I've always believed so."
"It took me years to understand that when you truly care about someone, you must focus on more than your own desires. To truly love something is not to desire a thing, but to desire its happiness. That's why love requires sacrifices. Sometimes painful ones."
He paused for emphasis.
"Some of the other boys Faye brings home I could never have this conversation with, but you're different. You understand my meaning.
His casual injection of other boys stung me, but I did not show it.
I think that I do.
I don't need to tell you that life is hard. You never know what's around the next bend, and sometimes it knocks the wind out of you. That's the way marriage is as well. How often do you see a couple years down the line still staring goo-goo-eyed at each other, hmm? It just doesn't happen.
He leaned forward, his brow bent in grave inquiry. No, sir.
It is because romantic love is an illusion. It portends an eternal round of ecstatic bliss with love conquering all. That's how all relationships start. But then the silver lining begins to tarnish and the honeymoon ends. Pretty soon she's complaining because you haven't been out to dinner for a month and there's not enough in the bank account, even while your boss is breaking your back.
He took another drink.
All relationships start on fire, but the embers cool.
Is that how it is with you and Mrs. Moreau? He didn't like my question, and for the first time I detected the anger that simmered beneath his calm facade. Then, inexplicably, his lips rose in a whimsical smile as if we had been playfully sparring, and I had just scored a point.
You do understand that romance will disappear. And then what have you? Only the life that you have built for yourselves.
I shifted uncomfortably in my chair. It may sound naive, but I think you're wrong. I believe it's after the honeymoon ends that true love begins. It's in the hard times that the greater virtues of love reveal themselves, like tolerance and patience and kindness. He cut me off.
Of course, that's the ideal. But where is the ideal, hm? There's always a marriage away, isn't it? For instance, do you think that your mother loved your father when she met him?
The reference to my parents caught me off guard. Of course she did.
And he loved her?
I suppose so. His mouth curled in a cruel, knowing grin.
And how did that all end up?
I set my napkin on the table. My father was an alcoholic.
We all have weaknesses, don't we? Only a fool claims to not. So, where did that leave your mother? Did his love save her?
It left my mother in a world of hurt.
You're a smart boy, Michael. You might make someone very happy if you can hold it all together. But how far does the apple fall from the tree?
As far as it needs to.
Maybe. In the rare case, but no one really knows. So, are you going to experiment with my Fay? Is that love?
His eyes were fierce.
It's ironic, isn't it? If you love Fay, you must let her go. If you care only about yourself, then you'll pursue her. It's not an easy decision, but it's a clear one.
I said nothing, biting back my growing anger.
Mind you, I do not say this to demean my daughter, but you must take it to heart. Fay is a free spirit, a compassionate free spirit, always the one to bring home the lost puppy. But there comes a price with that kind of spontaneity. Has Fay ever told you about her first car?
I folded my arms, awaiting the story.
A black and gold Pontiac Trans Am with a tea roof. For an entire year, it was all she talked about. As far as Fay was concerned, there was no other car. Being the dutiful parent on her 16th birthday, along with her driver's license, I saw to it that she got that car. It was less than 3 months before she wanted something else. The next model.
He paused for the analogy to settle.
Fay's off to a new world with a lot of handsome, clever boys from good homes and good lives. You don't really think that you can compete with that, do you? She may be content with a Trans Am now, but what happens when she rides in a Ferrari?
He took another drink as he ascertained how this was affecting me.
I would just hate to see you tossed aside for the next model. Fay leaves next Thursday. Maybe it's time to take your exit.
I pushed back from the table. It is time to take my exit. He realized my intent and waved as if it had all been in play.
No, no, sit down. Enjoy your meal. You've hardly touched it.
I guess I'm not used to rich foods. His countenance abruptly changed and his eyes narrowed in loathing.
I want to be very clear about something. I didn't raise Faye for 20-something years to throw it away on you. Faye's a smart girl. I believe she will move on of her own accord, but she is a volatile personality, and it wouldn't be the first time she has made a rash decision or a poor choice. So let me make things a little clearer for you. If Faye ends up engaged or committed to you in any permanent way, I will cut her off. No MasterCard, no tuition, no Johns Hopkins, no playing doctor.
You would never take that away from her? He did not wince.
Faye has two younger sisters that I must consider.
He leaned back confidently, his scotch in hand.
Frankly, all I would be doing is giving her a premature taste of what life with you would be like. Am I wrong?
You're a liar. His gaze was as black and hard as onyx.
Think of it as tough love.
Chapter 10. The Dilemma.
The most difficult of decisions are often not the ones in which we cannot determine the correct course, rather the ones in which we are certain of the path, but fear the journey.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. There was little new about the doctor's invective. He had only given voice to the specter that had shadowed me since I first met Faye. In the faithless corners of my mind, I had always expected her to move on. But if our relationship was an issue of faith, Faye had never given me reason to doubt. I could not say the same of myself. In truth, I didn't know just how much of my father's weaknesses I had inherited. I loathed my father for this, not just for who he was, but for who I was because of him. There was something about my father's ghost that I could not exorcise, and numbered among my greatest fears was to someday look into a mirror, only to see him staring back. Still, these fears cannot be relegated to the future. The doctor's threat to withhold funding from Faye's schooling, however, added immediate weight to our dilemma. His timing was impeccable, connivingly so, and if he had played that threat, counting on the possibility of my love to be a deterrent to our relationship, he had gambled correctly. I did love Faye more than myself. To threaten Faye's dreams at the verge of inception was something I could not do. No matter how he had manipulated the circumstance, even if he himself was the source of that pain. It is perhaps the greatest irony of love. That which we truly love, we must be willing to give up for its own benefit. And in this I knew how much Faye meant to me. For as breathless as the possibility of losing her left me, there was no question in my mind that I would lay down my heart as a stepping stone for her to reach her dreams. To do less would be a counterfeit of love, a forgery with no value other than what self-indulgent fraud could be had of it. That's what I knew. At least, that's what I thought I knew. What I had not factored into the equation, perhaps never dared to, is that I was the greater part of her dreams. My decision to not tell Faye about the dinner conversation required no great effort of deliberation. Faye had suffered enough pain for our relationship, and I had no desire to contribute to its accumulation. I probably would have never shared it with anyone if Esther hadn't asked. With me at her arm, she had just completed the first pass of her floor when we sat down to rest near the nurse's station.
Was your visitor from the university?
I frowned. Unfortunately not. It was Faye's father.
What did he want?
Same thing he always wants. Me out of his daughter's life.
Why is that?
He considers me white trash. He expects Faye to marry someone from a wealthy family with social prominence. He is certain that all I can promise his daughter is to keep her barefoot and pregnant.
He doesn't think you will someday be successful?
I don't think we share the same idea of success.
What does Faye think of this?
It's really hard on her. Her father forces the issue so that Faye must choose between him and me. Last night he threatened to cut Faye off financially if she ends up in any permanent relationship with me.
Would he?
I think he would. The man's evil. I sighed. I feel like I've been checkmated. I don't know what's worse, an absentee father like mine was, or a ubiquitous one like hers.
That is the first time you have mentioned your father to me.
He was no father, I said contemptuously. I raked my hand back through my hair. Oh, Faye's expecting a commitment. If I give her one, if she takes it, she loses her dreams. If I don't, I could lose her.
What will you do?
I don't know. I looked down the hallway, and for a moment watched Grace as she pushed her walker down the hall. How about your love, Esther? What about Thomas? I could not have predicted the effect of that name, or the dramatic change in mood it would evoke.
Where did you see that name?
She asked fiercely. Before I could answer, she said,
You read my letters.
What letters? Her face flushed.
You had no right to read my letters. You had no right to get into my drawer.
I glanced about as several of the residents were now watching.
I didn't read your letters, Esther. I don't know what letters you mean. That name was inscribed on the back of your locket, the one I found that day.
She covered her face with her hands.
I would like you to take me back to my room.
I waited for her emotion to settle. Then I slowly rose, taking her by the arm. She said nothing as I escorted her back.
I'm really sorry, I said contritely.
I didn't mean to upset you. I helped her to her chair.
It was just written on the locket.
Her hand caressed the oblong pendant, and she still didn't speak. And so I left the room, thinking about Thomas and her mysterious letters and what they might have to do with each other. I returned home that night to a letter of my own, correspondence printed on University of Utah letterhead, a letter of congratulations to the newest recipient of the university's presidential scholarship. Chapter 11. Christmas Eve.
It was a festive Christmas Eve in Betheltown, and we gathered at the church to sing and worship and feast. I returned near midnight, and shortly afterward a couple came to the inn seeking lodging. We had no vacancy, and as I was about to turn them out, the great irony of the circumstance was manifest. I gave them my room for the night and slept in the kitchen.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. December 24th fell with heavy snow that clung tenaciously to the roads until the highway patrol issued a traveler's advisory and began stopping cars at the base of the canyon to inspect for snow tires or tire chains. And still it fell, sealing in the solemnity of the day. Let it snow, I thought. Christmas had already come, packaged in the bright wrappings of a full-ride scholarship to the University of Utah. But if I was euphoric, I seemed staid in comparison to Faye. She had received the news with such elation that an outside observer would have thought that she had won the award. She insisted on braving the snowy canyons to bring me dinner and a bottle of non-alcoholic wine to celebrate my achievement. She stayed for more than an hour until I made her go, concerned by the worsening road conditions. I held her arm as I walked her out to her car and watched her cautiously descend the canyon until her car's taillights were no longer visible. From the roadway, the Arcadia appeared dark, an eclipse that carried inside to its sullen corridors, obscuring the plastic chains and decorations that I would soon bring down. I returned inside to help with the residents' dinner. For the holidays, forgotten ones, the cafeteria served instant potatoes and pressed turkey with canned cranberry sauce and a bread pudding of questionable consistency. A local church's plans to sing carols was canceled when the weather turned inclement, so most of the residents simply went to bed as if it were any other night, though a few gathered around the dayroom television to watch It's a Wonderful Life, hoping to provoke some semblance of the season's spirit. By the end of my shift, the home was still, disrupted only by the distant and frequent echo of Henri's strained hack. It was my first Christmas Eve without my mother, and the sadness of that thought had eaten away at the day's euphoria. I was saddened that my mother was not here to hear the news of my scholarship. She would have been proud, as she should be, for it would have been more her honor than mine. Then I remembered that I'd not yet told Esther about the award. I was still embarrassed by my previous night's faux pas with regard to Esther, and I suspect that I had subconsciously avoided her even though I had brought her a Christmas present, a peace offering of fruitcake, which I thought to bestow upon her at the first convenient opportunity. That opportunity had never come, and I assumed that by this hour my chance was past, as she had likely been whisked away for Christmas Eve festivities in the home of some nearby relative. I clocked out and had already donned my coat and gloves when I decided to just leave the gift in her room. I climbed the stairway and knocked softly at her door, then, expecting to find the room vacant, slowly opened it. The room was dark except for the weak illumination of a single low wattage lamp on her nightstand. To my surprise, Esther sat alone in the darkness, her eyelids fluttering with the weight of fatigue. I stepped into the room. "Esther?" She spoke without turning.
"Hello, Michael."
I laid my gloves on her bureau, then sat down on the bed next to her. "I brought you something." I set the ornate, paisley-adorned tin in her lap. "It's a fruitcake." She clasped both hands over the gift, running her slender fingers across the container's tin lip.
"That was very thoughtful of you."
She looked very sad.
"It snowed today, didn't it?"
I looked toward the undraped window, the navy sky dotted by white flakes. "It's still snowing. The roads are pretty bad."
"You didn't have an automobile accident, did you?"
"No, I got here all right."
"I don't care much for snow. You can slip on it and break a hip."
"I imagine so."
"Doctors like snow, I think. It keeps them in country clubs, fixing all those broken hips."
"I've never really thought of it like that." The room fell quiet. I threaded my fingers together in my lap. "Do you have plans for tonight?" She nodded, her gesture betrayed by a forlorn countenance.
"My son is coming for me."
"Good," I said.
"Have you plans?"
"No, just work. I'm off now, though."
"Why aren't you spending it with that girl of yours?"
"Faye's spending the night with her family. We were planning to spend tomorrow together."
"I expect that will be lovely."
The melancholy was suffocating. "Well, I'd best be on my way before the roads get much worse."
"Thank you," she said.
I took my gloves from the bureau and shoved them into my pockets. "I wanted to apologize again about the other day. It wasn't any of my business." Again, Esther did not respond to my apology. "Well, Merry Christmas."
"And to you, Michael,"
she said softly. I quickly stepped from the room, closed the door behind me, and descended the stairs. Sharon had just arrived at the front counter for the night shift, and my approach startled her.
"Hi, Michael. I thought Alice was scheduled for tonight."
"She wanted it off, and I needed the money."
"I hear you. Christmas always leaves me broke. That's why I'm working. It was either work or wassail and caroling at Aunt Maud's."
I glanced down at my watch.
"Do you know what time Esther's son is coming for her?"
She looked at me quizzically.
Esther doesn't have any children.
Are you certain?
Esther hasn't had a visitor in the 3 years I've been here. She had a surgery a few years back, and when I checked her file for next of kin, the line was blank. Makes you wonder where people like her come from. It's Eleanor Rigby-ish.
I looked back toward the stairway for a moment, then turned to leave.
I'll see you Monday.
Have a good Christmas.
Outside, the snow fell steadily, gathering in vertical blankets across the craggy walls of the canyon, reflecting the moon's light in a translucent glow. The road was silent, abandoned of travelers, who had settled in for the night's festivities or maybe just sleep. I suspect that it was my own loneliness that turned me around. Sharon looked up as I walked back in.
Forget something?
I left something upstairs. I climbed the stairs to Esther's room and knocked gently.
Esther?
I pushed open her door. Esther was still in her chair, her eyes closed, her hand still clasped over the tin.
Did you forget something, Michael?
I forgot to tell you, I won the scholarship.
Despite her sadness, she smiled.
I am so pleased. You must be very excited.
It's the first thing I've ever won. I was glad that she was pleased. I walked to her side, then sat down on the bed next to her.
What time is your son coming by?
About 8.
It's nearly 9:30.
Oh, he must be detained. You said the roads aren't very good.
Her lie filled me with sadness.
Esther,
I paused, uncertain if I was right to speak, but somehow unable to constrain myself.
Esther, you don't have a son.
Esther said nothing. And while I wondered what idiocy had possessed me, a single tear streamed down her cheek, and she brushed it back. Then her voice fell wearily.
I did once, Michael.
Tears began to fall copiously, and she no longer made an effort to wipe them back. I took a tissue from her nightstand and placed it in her hand, and she dabbed her eyes. Put my hand on hers.
Tell me about him.
His name was Matthew. He was my sweet boy.
I asked softly,
where is Matthew?
He's gone.
She lowered her head into her hands.
Matthew was severely retarded. In 1948, I came down with the scarlet fever. And because I was alone, the state took Matthew to an institution. It would only be for a time. How could he know that he would be coming back?
Her eyes again filled with tears.
He stopped living without me. How could he have known?
I'm sorry.
I looked at the photograph of the soldier as I thought a piece to the puzzle had been given to me.
The picture on your bureau. The soldier is Matthew's father.
She shook her head, and her tone changed from grief to insolence.
No. I have no photographs of Matthew's father. I don't want any. He was no father.
I understand. I don't want any photographs of my father either.
She continued to dab her eyes.
Who is the soldier?
Esther did not speak for more than a minute. It was as if she stood before some great sealed book, contemplating whether or not to breach its cover. Suddenly she said dolefully,
"The soldier is Thomas. He is the only man I have ever loved, perhaps the only to truly love me."
I was astonished that she had shared such a thing.